Synchronicity. The word was coined by Carl Jung to describe what he called temporally coincident occurrences of acausal events. But you can just call it coincidence or pure dumb luck. Either good or bad luck, it depends on the situation. Or call it interconnectedness, poorly understood by human beings, going all the way back to the Big Bang. Sometimes synchronicity is just amusing, something that makes you go, Sometimes it is instructive and amusing. To illustrate, several years ago I was in the Boise Public Library looking for a particular book which the card catalog computer told me was on the shelf. When I got to that shelf, the book wasn't there, but in the exact spot where it should have been was a misfiled book titled Synchronicity. I had learned not to ignore synchronicity, so of course I checked the book out and read it. Occasionally, synchronicity can change your life. In 1989, Wanda and I had left Alaska and were looking for a new place to live. We were in Texas and the job search wasn't going well. We couldn't find anything in the smaller towns where we wanted to live, but Wanda received a job offer in San Antonio, which is a nice place to visit, but we didn't want to live there. She had applied to teach in several places around the Northwest, though, and Boise called, asking her to come for an interview. It would have cost us over $800 apiece round trip to fly from San Antonio to Boise, and we weren't willing to spend that much. But a few days earlier, we had given up our seats on an overbooked flight from El Paso to Dallas-Fort Worth in exchange for two free Delta tickets anywhere in the 48 contiguous states. So we flew to Boise for free, Wanda got the job, and we've been here for 21 years now. It wasn't much of a leap for us, as we had lived our lives on synchronicity for many years, even before we knew the word and what it meant. You could also call it opportunism. We generally took the road less traveled by, following the advice of that sage American prophet, Yogi Berra, who said, "If you come to a fork in the road, take it." I have a feeling that many of you are the same way, even if you don't realize it, even if you don't really think about it. For all our planning, life turns out to be more a matter of luck, translated as opportunity, than anything else. So you say, what does all this have to do with Waikiki and walk lights? Well, I'm glad you asked. In the summer of 1988, Wanda and I were studying at the University of Hawaii to meet Alaska's teaching certificate renewal requirements, taking advantage of synchronicity, the reciprocal agreement between Hawaii and Alaska granting each other students resident tuition. My aunt and uncle were vacationing in Hawaii at the same time, synchronicity, and after walking around Waikiki for a few days, Uncle John observed that the button marked "to cross street, push button, wait for light" didn't seem to have any actual effect on the light. No matter how hard you pushed it or how many times, the light went through its own sequence before you got a walk. He suspected the buttons were just there to create the illusion that you actually have some control over your environment. Now, that got me to thinking. Suppose, just for a moment, that life in modern America is a busy Waikiki intersection, and most of the buttons we push every day are like the ones at those intersections. Some of us scrupulously push the button, wait for the light, then cross the intersection between the white lines and never question the system. Some don't wait for the light, but cross when and where they choose, and if they don't get hit by the bus, excuse me, I got hit by the bus and lost my place. If they don't get hit by the bus, they are either cheered or jeered by the crowd back on the sidewalk. In fact, some of the good law-abiding pedestrians might decide these people are a threat to public order, grab them and punish them for their errant behavior. Some people never get to the light in time. My sister is one of them. They rush across just as it blinks its final warning and get flattened by the bus. Then sometimes the light gets stuck. You keep pushing, but the light doesn't change, and you have to come up with an alternative plan, maybe even walking down to the next intersection and waiting for the light at that corner. There are some people who are colorblind, some who lack the ability to interpret abstract symbols, who can't decipher words or pictographs, who are autistic, etc., etc. And unless someone helps them or makes alternative provisions for crossing the street, they get left behind, or worse, they get hit by the bus. Then there are a few who figure out the system's timing well enough. They can walk up and push the button just before the light changes, making it appear to others, and perhaps to themselves, that they can indeed control the system. Those less capable watch in awe, then follow these charismatic leaders to the other side of the street or wherever else they might lead. Whether or not the buttons are connected to the lights, we assume that somewhere in the mighty halls of the city and county of Honolulu is an omniscient central traffic control system that works to the ultimate benefit of all. But even if we knew where it was, we could never get in because the security is so tight. Maybe it contains a great mainframe computer programmed to keep everything working just as it should. Or maybe there's a person, a central controller, sitting at a console, watching us, changing the lights as needed, or just throwing switches capriciously to mess with our minds. Or maybe everyone is Pauhana, quit work, gone surfing. Maybe there's no central control system at all. The lights just change of their own accord, randomly headed toward ultimate chaos. But perhaps the most frightening prospect is that we truly are in control, pushing individual buttons at our own whim. If we do assume the buttons are connected to the lights and the lights to a central system, the buttons and lights might still be a way for the system to control us rather than vice versa, to condition us to interact with it on its own terms. The system was there, after all, running through its own patterns long before we caught the 767 to HNL. And in spite of all our efforts at control, we still face the grim possibility that one day the brakes on the bus will fail and it will plunge through a crowded intersection at the peak of rush hour. Most of us have grown up with a similar system, though, and we feel we can handle the walk lights ourselves, that we are free and independent and need no one else to help until we encounter a power failure or gridlock or a tsunami or the bus. We probably feel we've attained a state of walk-lightenment, that we're more walk-lightened than those who live in places with fewer nor walk-lights, and that we should see that they get walk-lights as soon as possible, whether they want them or not, whether they have cars or not, whether they have electricity or not. Someone who has lived all his life on a South Pacific island without walk lights and who comes to Hawaii is puzzled at first, but eventually learns that when cars stop, he can cross the street safely. Then he realizes the car stopped when the red light comes on, and so forth, until he figures out that he can push the button, the car stop, the little white man lights up, and he can cross the street himself. But somewhere in the back of his mind is the unsettling realization that he is no longer truly free, no longer in control. He's just been conditioned to make best use of the system. He has become bound by that system, subject to its limitations, and subject to the danger of the bus. We've learned to use the system so efficiently that a few of us have even developed the extra time to dawdle on the street corner, debating among ourselves whether this is really a walk light we're observing or merely an imperfect image of walk lightness. Some question the political correctness of the lights. The pedestrian crossing light used to read walk and don't walk. though some felt the latter was too negative. And perhaps they asked for a light that said, "Free to be you and me," which would allow you to walk, run, skip, cartwheel, or just stand there. Of course, allowing for those who might not be able to read English, most lights are now pictographs of a big red hand, palm outward, meaning don't walk, and a little white silhouette of a walking man, meaning, okay, now it's safe to walk. But perhaps someone complained that such a symbol seemed to indicate that only white males were allowed to walk. So in some places, you now see an androgynous red standing figure and an androgynous green walking figure. Maybe we will grow curious and dismantle the button box to see what makes it work, only to find a mass of wires running to the light, with a larger, more tangled mass running from it, disappearing into the darkness beneath the street. We might try to gain more thorough control by stationing ourselves at strategic points to report conditions to someone in a central street-side location who has an iPhone with a thumb app on it, which he can use to activate remote control thumbs that push the button at selected intersections at the desired moment. But as the city and the number of tourists grow, as there are more cars and more people, the system reaches saturation and develops terminal gridlock, perhaps compounded by decaying infrastructure and a tsunami or two. People unable to cross the street resort to blaming each other. They polarize into groups. Let's call one group the move on across the roaders, and we'll call another group the teed off partisans. Each group says it's for change, but in the end, nothing changes but the light. The groups resort to verbal abuse, each calling the other fascists and communists at the same time. Someone shouts, "Your leader is a rollerblading socialist terrorist who wasn't even born in Hawaii." Someone from the other group shouts back, "Your last leader was a Segway rider with terminal attention deficit disorder, and his vice leader was Rosemary's baby." Verbal abuse turns to physical abuse, and those from both sides try to throw the others under the bus. The system is on the verge of collapse. Perhaps 2,000 years from now, archaeologists will dig up the ruins of Waikiki and wonder what kind of culture this was that so worshipped the giant red hand and the little white walking man that it erected illuminated images of these deities at every street corner. Then is heard the voice of one crying in the wilderness, saying that the rich oligarchs control the system for their own benefit, that they just use the division among the pedestrian groups to maintain control, to discourage pedestrianism and encourage everyone to pay to ride the bus, which they own. The people then have to decide, one, whether or not this prophet is right, and two, whether they can actually affect change in the system, or do they just have to get on the bus and go along with it? Three weeks ago, on Monday, July 12th, Wanda and I got off the bus at the Auschwitz concentration camp. Between 1940 and 45, 1.1 million people died there, including nearly a million Jews and over 100,000 others, Polish dissidents and potential dissidents, Russian prisoners of war, gypsies. 3 days later, on July 15th, we were riding a tour bus through Dresden, Germany, a beautiful old city on the banks of the Elbe River. On February 13th and 14th, 1945, Dresden had been destroyed by British and American bombers, burned to the ground by Royal Air Force expertise in creating firestorms in cities. 25,000 people died, perhaps more. German civilians and soldiers, Poles, Czechs, and other refugees fleeing the Russian advance from the east, and American prisoners of war. Over a million at Auschwitz in 5 years, 25,000 at Dresden in one night. just a small fraction of all who died in World War II. Those people did not start the war. Many did not fight in it. None could stop it or escape it. They ran out of buttons to push. Sometimes the frantic effort to get across the street becomes insignificant in the face of the greater reality. In Krakow, Poland, our tour bus stopped briefly at a nondescript building, former location of Oskar Schindler's enamel factory. Schindler was a German businessman who saved 1,100 Jewish employees from almost certain death at the hands of the Nazis. There were others, Raoul Wallenberg, Gioni Sugihara, Corrie ten Boom and her family. American Unitarian minister Waitstill Sharp and his wife Martha, who all worked to save people from the Nazi machine. Still, it's estimated that less than 0.1% of Europeans in German-controlled areas undertook such risky business. The night after our visit to Auschwitz, we had dinner in the Klezmer House in Krakow. Polish Jewish food followed by a concert of klezmer music, lively, life-affirming Yiddish blend of various musical influences. It was a so there to the mentality that brought about places like Auschwitz. And as a side note, you can see and hear the musicians from the Klezmer House on YouTube under the name Quartet Klezmer Trio, which is a rather strange name, but they play great music. And in Dresden, after we got off the bus, we went to the Frauenkirche with a stream of other tourists. The Frauenkirche, loosely Church of Our Lady, was built in the early 1700s, a huge Baroque Lutheran church, square on the outside, round on the inside. And it was destroyed in the 1945 bombing. Reconstruction began after the East German government dissolved itself, and the church was reconsecrated in 2005. When I walked inside, I felt compelled to sit down in a pew in the back and just absorb it all. We had visited several Baroque churches during our travels, and their extravagance had caused me to joke that it was easy to see why the local communities were Baroque. But this one was something else. This was, as was the Klezmer House in Krakow on a smaller scale, an affirmation of life, a sign that Dresden lives, a symbol of the human ability to prevail against the destructive forces of evil. The Frauenkirche was rebuilt with contributions from individuals, businesses, and organizations in Germany, Great Britain, America, and other places. The largest individual contributor was a German-American named Günter Blobel, who as a boy of 11 had witnessed the Dresden firestorm. In 1999, he won the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine and contributed the total amount, over $1 million, to the reconstruction of Dresden, particularly to the Frauenkirche and to the building of the new synagogue to replace one that had been burned down during Kristallnacht in 1938. While I was traveling in Europe through its historic cities with centuries of commerce, culture, religion, and war, visiting public buildings that are still in use that were built before Europeans even realized America existed, I had a dream in which it seemed perfectly clear that in the end, the tyranny of organized theism and the tyranny of organized atheism mean absolutely nothing. More than a particular religion, the Frauenkirche is a symbol of our common humanity, of something we all understand, of something that connects us all. That interconnectedness I spoke of earlier in relation to synchronicity. And that is why so many people felt it worthwhile, necessary, to spend the money and the effort to rebuild it, and the new synagogue, and the Semper Opera House, and the rest of Dresden, and why so many people visit those places today. And if you find in that common humanity a sense of God, then perhaps that is where it resides. Perhaps the buttons are just there to make us feel good and aren't really connected to anything at all. After all, the Nazis bullied their way into control of a democratic government in Germany, something that could never happen in the United States to 2000. But maybe the pedestrians do have some power. Maybe enough of us pushing enough buttons could stop the traffic. The news has not been good here in the last week. And I could list several examples, but most of you have probably heard them. Maybe we need to just forget the walk light buttons, forget trying to cross the street, and circumvent the system, find a new way to do what needs to be done. Do we want history to remember us as it does Germany's biggest Unitarian church, which just sat and hoped for the best as the Nazis took over? Or as it does Martha and Waitstill Sharp, who traveled to Europe and worked to save as many people as they could before and during the war? My fellow Texan Jim Hightower said, "The opposite of courage is not cowardice, it is conformity. Even a dead fish can go with the flow." Sooner or later, we all ride the bus, but did you check the destination to see where it's going before you got on board? The optimist believes we live in the best of all possible worlds. The pessimist fears that this is true. So, take care of each other because we might be all that we have. Love your enemies, but don't let them start putting people into boxcars. And be good stewards of the earth so your grandchildren can enjoy it as much as you have. And the next time you think you're pushing all the right buttons, look up to make sure the bus isn't bearing down on you. Thank you.